Hello, and welcome to the 8th episode of Season 3 of The Dark Money Files, in which we shine a light into a murky world. I'm Ray Blake, and with me is my co-host, friend and business partner, Graham Barrow. Hello, Graham.
Hello, Ray.
Peps today, then, is it?
Yes, Ray. As part of a set of episodes looking at some of the high-risk situations that banks and other institutions have to deal with, Peps seems like a good starting point.
Okay. So what's a PEP, Graham?
Well, in this context, it's a politically exposed person, which for all sorts of reasons actually isn't a great label.
Well, indeed. So what sorts of people are we talking about, Graham?
Well, politicians, obviously, but all sorts of people with roles in government or who enjoy particular influence in and around governments and, frankly, other organs of state or society.
I think that's going to need unpacking a bit, Graham.
Ray, I hear you, and it's not that easy to do. But I think the best place to start is to understand what the risks are from a money laundering point of view when we look at, I don't know, say a government minister.
Good idea. I suppose that primarily we worry about bribery and corruption because of their access to government funds and their ability to award government contracts and patronage.
Yeah, that's at the heart of this, Ray. It's not just their access to government finances per se, but the influence they have and can exert potentially on flows of funds. Now, for example, senior members of judiciaries don't hand out public money or government contracts, but their actions in office can have far-reaching benefits or costs to people hoping to receive government contracts or funds.
I see. So that's two types of PEP we've identified, government ministers and senior judges. How senior is senior, I wonder?
That's a good question, Ray. Generally, we're talking about judges senior enough that their judgments are not subject to appeal in higher courts. But in this, as in all things PEP, there's often a need to take a risk-based view at the outer edges of that definition.
Just at the outer edges, Graham?
Yes, Ray, I think so. Throughout Europe and in most jurisdictions, there exist lists of roles that firms should treat as PEPs. There isn't any discretion if you sit unambiguously on that list. But where the definition relies on subjective terms like senior, firms have to apply their own risk-based judgments.
Now, that doesn't make it easy for firms to act consistently. And that's why under a European directive coming into force in 2020, each member state will have to draw up a definitive list of specific roles that qualify as PEPs and publish those lists.
Yeah, and that's a useful development and will prevent some of the inconsistencies we see now, well, at least in EU member states.
So we have government ministers, senior judges. Who else, Graham?
Well, if we take the UK legislation as representative, and I think it largely is, the list includes, and this is quite a long one, but I'm going to read it, so bear with me. Quote, A, heads of state, heads of government, ministers and deputy or assistant ministers. B, members of parliament or of similar legislative bodies. C, members of the governing bodies of political parties. D, members of supreme courts, of constitutional courts, or of any judicial body, the decisions of which are not subject to further appeal except in exceptional circumstances. Pretty definitive. E, members of courts of auditors or of the boards of central banks. F, ambassadors, chargés d'affaires and high-ranking officers in the armed forces. Members of the administrative, management or supervisory bodies of state-owned enterprises or SOEs. And H, lastly, directors, deputy directors and members of the board or equivalent function of an international organisation.
Well, that's quite a list. I see that the UK has been quite specific about the level of judges that are included, but unfortunately less so for officers in the armed forces. I mean, I don't suppose high ranking is further defined, is it?
No, Ray, it isn't.
As far as government is concerned, the focus seems to be on national rather than local government too.
That's right, Ray, but that's quite a UK-centric approach. The UK, after all, is a small country and most government functions sit at a national level. You know, in other countries where government is more greatly devolved, you'd expect to look closely at those in local government structures too.
Yes, I can see that. And I suppose also in systems where you have government that's split between federal government and individual state governments too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. There are a couple of terms towards the end of the list we might look at defining, I think, Graham.
Oh?
Well, yes. I mean, international organisation, for instance. That's loosely worded, isn't it? That could cover all sorts of bodies.
Well, yes, it could. But I think we need to bear in mind the purpose of the provisions. We're interested in people who can influence the flow of public money. So we'd be more focused on an organisation that's set up by, say, several national governments than we would, say, of a commercial multinational company.
OK, so OPEC, yes, Coca-Cola, no.
A phrase I use all the time. That is about the size of it, though. But think about access to public funds. International sporting organisations and aid charities, for instance, are in that position.
Got it. Then we have state-owned enterprises, don't we?
Yeah. Now, this would include nationalised companies and things like state airlines, where they are publicly owned, as well as public-private partnership.
What about organisations where the state has just a minority interest, Graham? If I sit on the board of a company where the government owns 5% of it, am I a PEP?
Oh, it's complicated, Ray.
Oh, I was afraid you'd say that.
Well, the OECD defines a state-owned enterprise as, quote, an enterprise where the state has significant control through full, majority, or significant minority ownership.
I see. So where the ownership is full or majority, so more than 50%, we can obviously assume significant control. In cases of significant minority ownership, let's say 40%, I think that would be significant minority ownership, we'd need to have a view of whether the state had significant control of the entity.
Yeah, so factors such as golden shares, powers to appoint directors, the government's influence on decision-making in the SOE and so on would support a significant control argument. But a rationale could be made that such a minority ownership does not, in the case in question, constitute significant influence.
OK, that makes sense, Graham.
I think we should look at what the elevated risks are and how firms are expected to control them, Ray.
Good idea, Graham. As we said, this is always going to be about bribery and corruption risk, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right, Ray. That's not to say that all public officials are corrupt. Well, not all of them. Not that even very many of them are, simply that their exposure is much greater by virtue of their position.
Sure. And we can all cite examples of people who've used their position for personal gain instead of the public good.
Oh, yes. So the controls that banks are expected to apply here focus on ensuring that when they handle the PEP's money, it is genuinely the legitimately owned property of the PEP and doesn't represent and hasn't been commingled with public funds or illicit earnings.
OK, so we might expect specific transaction monitoring scenarios for such accounts.
Yes, Ray.
And the bank will want to be very clear about the source of funds passing into the account.
That's certainly true, but equally they'll want to have a good understanding of the PEP's source of wealth.
Ah, yes. Now, this can be quite a difficult concept to understand, can't it?
Yeah, it is often confused with source of funds.
Okay, so source of funds refers to the origin of money coming into the account, doesn't it? Both where specifically that money is coming from, say a personal account in the client's name in Germany, and how the money was actually generated or earned by the client.
Yeah, that's right. And source of wealth, on the other hand, is the activities or circumstances by which the client came by their total wealth in the first place.
So, did they inherit wealth, and if so, when and from whom, or are they self-made?
In which case, what were the businesses or job from which they accumulated their wealth?
So we have to ask the client some fairly intrusive questions then.
Yes, we do. But asking the client isn't going to be enough. To properly establish source of wealth, you need a three-step approach, Ray.
Ah, yes. Now, I think I know this one. You have to start with an assessment or estimate of their overall net worth.
Yes, all of it. Whether you as a bank have anything to do with all of it or whether you only take care of a small part of it.
Yeah, that's a great point. Okay, then. Next, you have to understand and record the different activities and circumstances that have brought about that amount. So, jobs, business ventures, inheritances, whatever.
That's right. You should be able to tell the story of how the client amassed the wealth they have today, even if that's quite complicated.
Okay, got it. What's the third step?
You have to be able to verify that narrative, Ray.
What, all of it?
Not necessarily. You should take a risk-based approach. For the highest risk clients, where as well as them being PEPs, there are specific red flags, you'd want evidence all the way. But generally, no, you'd look at verifying parts of the story.
So it's not just about taking the client's word for it then?
No, it's not. Sometimes the evidence is fairly easy to get hold of. If the PEP's wealth all comes from entrepreneurial business, you can get historical accounts, and often from public sources.
Yes, and if the money was inherited, there will have been a lawyer involved who can verify the amounts and dates.
That's true.
You often hear of wealth deriving from sale of assets, so presumably receipts or contract notes would do for that.
Well, those would evidence the sale and the proceeds, Ray, but I'm not sure that really helps us with source of wealth.
Why?
Well, because the sale of assets doesn't tell us how the assets were acquired in the first place.
Oh, I see. I suppose we really need to be clear on the point of determining the source of that wealth, don't we?
Yes, we do. We want to know the amount of wealth the client has and its source, so that we can determine both when we accept the relationship and throughout the period that we have the relationship, that we are exposed only to legitimately owned funds and assets.
So that if we know a guy is worth £5 million all tied up in property, and we see £5 million go through his account in cash that isn't the proceeds of property sale, we will ask the right questions.
Well, exactly.
Well, that seems fairly clear. Of course, if you were a PEP with dirty money to shift, you'd be naive to expect you could move it through your own personal account in this day and age.
That is very true, and it's why we have to apply the same controls as we would to the personal account of a PEP to any account where the PEP is himself or herself a ultimate beneficial owner or UBO.
So that means a company they own a significant chunk of, or a foundation or a trust where they're a settlor, founder, trustee, whatever.
That's right, Ray. Of course, this is well known and you're well informed corrupt PEP, and there are a few of those these days, we'll know that's a non-starter too.
Okay, so if you can't disguise your ownership that way, what are your options?
Friends and relatives, if you've got any.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Hence the requirement to extend PEP controls to certain relatives, friends and associates of any PEP, so we can close down that route as well.
That's right, Ray. I normally talk about RCAs, or relatives and close associates.
Yes, and for most purposes, you'd treat an RCA in the same way as a PEP, wouldn't you?
Yeah, but there's one important difference, and that's that an RCA cannot themselves have RCAs.
Come again, Graham?
See, we look at the RCAs of a PEP, so this would include friends of a PEP, but we don't go as far as to look at the friends of their friends.
Okay, I get it. That could quickly get out of control otherwise.
Quite so, yes. But by looking at both entities in which PEPs have an interest and their RCAs, we're looking to shut down any routes by which they might expect to be able to disguise illicit fund flows. But there is still a loophole.
Yeah, there is. For that to work, you have to be sure you know all the RCAs and you have to know all the entities in which the PEP has an ownership share.
Spot on, Ray. PEPs can be well-connected people and often have quite diverse networks. How far would you take that?
We'd need, as ever, to take a risk-based approach, Graham. Where you've got a PEP with other flashing red flags, you might want to appoint an external specialist investigator to map the RCAs fully. However, getting someone to help you launder money implies a certain degree of closeness, wouldn't you say?
Yes, I would agree with that. In most cases, that will be a manageable set of people once you get beyond immediate family members.
Yeah, and immediate family members is hardly likely to include dodgy brothers-in-law, is it?
No.
Okay. One close relationship that often gets underestimated, though, is an ex-spouse or an ex-partner. It's not uncommon for such relationships to look firmly rooted in the past, but in reality, a close present relationship can still exist.
Well, that's right, even to the point that a public split might just be stage managed specifically to open up such a channel in the future, which would then go under the radar.
That's so sneaky.
Well, yeah, I suppose it is. And the other complication we ought to look at is the issue of PEP retirement.
Ah, yes. The law in many jurisdictions allows you to stop treating a person as a PEP a certain time after they leave the role that made them a PEP. So if your PEP retires from his public role today, you might be able to decide in, say, 2 years' time that she's no longer a PEP.
Yes, you might. But you might want to give that some thought.
Yes, you'd want to be reasonably sure that she hadn't left the role in name only and actually continued to keep her hands on the reins.
Or in the till, right?
well, quite, yes.
You'd also want to understand whether, notwithstanding their having left the role, they still retain significant political influence, wouldn't you?
Yes, and you'd want to check whether they'd actually taken on a different role that made them a PEP as well.
You know, that's an excellent point, Ray, and it raises another one too. Quite often we determine that a person is a PEP, we set appropriate controls, and then don't go back and check in reviews, say, that they are not only still a PEP, but they are still a PEP that has the same roles and the same exposures, and that therefore our existing controls remain the right ones.
But coming back to PEP retirement, we know firms that despite the ability to retire their PEPs, actually adopt a once a PEP, always a PEP rule, don't we?
We do, Ray.
And two questions for you, Graham. First, why do they do that? And second, do we think it's a good idea?
Well, as to why, it actually makes life easier, paradoxically. Although it means more intensive controls, they don't have to worry about considering PEP retirement, and nor do they have to worry about getting that decision wrong.
There's also the fact that if they're operating globally, in some jurisdictions, they're legally obliged to consider the PEP always a PEP, even after retirement. So it would be inconvenient for them to have to treat someone as a PEP in some countries and not a PEP in others.
That's absolutely right. And of course, if that is known, it could easily be exploited.
Oh, yes, of course.
And as for your other question as to whether it's a good idea, well, you know, I have conflicting views on that.
Oh?
Well, on the one hand, a risk-based approach dictates that you shouldn't overcommit your AML resources to cases in which the risk is reduced. So retiring your PEPs would be a good idea.
But on the other hand?
Well, Ray, let me ask you some questions.
Okay.
Let's say you have a senior government role, and you ought to. It's well paid, and you have a good life.
I do, don't I? This is sounding good, Graham.
Yeah, but that's not quite great enough for you, Ray.
Ooh.
It's really easy for you to make a great big pile of cash out of your position, and the temptation proves just too much.
Oh, that's a real shame, Graham. Curse my venality and weakness.
If I knew what that meant. Yes, Ray, as you say. But let's say you leave office after a few years of public service and a certain amount of self-service.
Okay, yep.
Now, you've got a nice government pension and you know that people are going to be watching your finances. How are you going to act?
Well, I'd be mad to do anything with the money too quickly. I'd want to keep it hidden until people had forgotten about me.
Never forget about you, Ray, but I agree. So if you spent, let's say, 5 years or so enjoying your legitimate pensions and staying well away from PEP-type roles, there's a decent chance your bank would have declassified you as a PEP, and you might then feel you had the ability to start accessing the proceeds of your rotten corruption. And you might be right.
Yeah, that does sound like a risk for banks.
Yes, it does. So I'm really in two minds about whether the banks ought to make use of the PEP retirement provisions where they exist. If they do decide to allow PEP retirement, I'd certainly advise them to look carefully at each one on a case-by-case basis and be sure to review the decision whenever the client comes due for review.
Yes, that sounds sensible. So, we've looked at the whys and wherefores of PEPs, politically exposed persons. We've seen how you become regarded as a PEP, the types of roles that qualify you. We've looked at the risks of banking a PEP.
Or the friend or relative of a PEP or a business they own part of.
Yes, and we've looked at how and why you need clarity on their source of wealth.
Yep, and finally we've looked at the perhaps controversial issue of PEP retirement, or if you prefer, declassification.
I think that'll do for this episode then, Graham. What are we going to look at next?
Well, Ray, PEPs represent one of the high-risk situations and factors that banks need to adopt special approaches for, but there are others, of course. I think we should identify the main ones and talk about the approaches each of them need over the next couple of episodes.
I'm looking forward to it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Dark Money Files. We hope you enjoyed it. If you would like to listen to future episodes, please subscribe through iTunes, Spotify, or your normal podcast provider. Thanks.